Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Alice McKeon, your chair for today. I would like to welcome the NorCal Peace Corps Association and to thank them and the club's International Relations Member-Led Forum, along with the club's Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum, for supporting this program. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Larry Roeter was a news correspondent in Brazil for 14 years. From 1977 to 1982, he worked for Newsweek magazine. Then from 1998 to 2007, he was bureau chief for the New York Times in Rio de Janeiro. He has also covered Asian and American politics, including the 2008 presidential election campaign, and is now a culture reporter for The Times. Born and raised in Chicago, Mr. Roeter is a graduate of the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, where he majored in history, politics, and economics. He has a master's degree from Columbia University's School of International Affairs, where he specialized in modern Chinese history and politics. He is the author of the 2008 Portuguese language bestseller, Deu no New York Times, A Foreigner's Look at Life in Brazil, and Brazil on the Rise, The Story of a Country Transformed, which was published this August by Palgrave Macmillan. Please welcome Larry Roeter.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm gratified, really, as I was saying to Alice before we started, that there's been so much interest in my book and in Brazil, west of the Rockies. You know, we expect it in places like Miami, where I started my book tour, because Brazil is Florida's number one trading partner, and Brazilians are now the number one foreign tourist group in the state. But in parts of the U.S. where you don't see a historic relationship with Brazil, it's a very pleasant surprise to be invited and have the opportunity to talk about Brazil. Well, let me start by explaining what led me to write this book. It really has to do with the phenomenon, kind of artificial, the terminology invented by Goldman Sachs in 2003 when they created the BRIC group, Brazil, Russia, India, China. And the truth is that we are so focused on India and China, for good reasons, that it seemed to me that some of the really astonishing changes, I used the word transformation in the subtitle of my book, that some of those transformations that are taking place in Brazil were being overlooked. And I wanted to remedy that. I think that as Americans, we have a particular set of images of Brazil when we think of the country. Pelé with a soccer ball, the girl from Ipanema, usually in a skimpy bathing suit on the beach, carnival and samba, all those people shimmying, the Amazon in flames, the Christ the Redeemer statue over Rio with its arms outspread. And I should mention to you, actually, the week before last when I did a presentation in New York at the America Society, I enumerated that list, and a young guy in the audience, 25, 27, he called out from his seat, "Don't forget the supermodels." So I guess then, you know, I should acknowledge Gisele Bündchen and Daniela Saraiva and Adriana Lima and all the others. But it's a kind of limited set of images. And I'm not saying it's incorrect, because all of that is part of Brazil. What I would say is that it's incomplete and that those images we have are increasingly less related to the reality of the country that is emerging. Let me cite some examples that I think are not general knowledge in the United States when it comes to Brazil. Last month, for example, an investment group based in São Paulo bought Burger King for just under $4 billion. Another investment group from São Paulo, and in fact, I should get the cover. This, by the way, is downtown São Paulo, the largest financial and banking center in the Southern Hemisphere. So it's not to be, it's not surprising that a São Paulo investment group bought Burger King, and that some of the members of that group were also involved in 2008 in the purchase of Anheuser-Busch, which is now essentially a Brazilian company as well. So if you eat a Whopper or drink a Bud, you are now contributing to the strengthening of the Brazilian economy. Beyond that, well, keeping in the vein of the economy, Brazil is today the fourth largest creditor of the United States. We all know about China having $2 trillion plus in assets, in reserves, mostly denominated in dollars. Then comes Japan, then comes the UK. Brazil is number four. They have $250 billion plus in reserves, $165 billion of which is held in U.S. Treasury bonds, securities, you know, other instruments. You know, this kind of, I think, passes unperceived by most of us here in the U.S. And it's not really, it's not limited just to economics either. I have a chapter in the book on culture, and Brazilian culture has kind of infiltrated, global culture in ways that we also may not automatically perceive. For example, recently I went to see the new Cirque du Soleil show in New York, and it's completely Brazilian music. The whole thing is various genres of Brazilian music. And I don't think even one person in 20 in the audience was aware of that. Another example, some of you may have seen the film City of God that came out, five, six, maybe even 7 years ago. That film really was riveting to people in Hollywood because there were all kinds of innovative visual techniques being employed. And so not just the director has gone on to have a successful career, but the cinematographers, the cameramen, because the world cinema industry wanted to kind of exploit those techniques that were being created there. And so when I look today, I see, you know, MTV videos, I see commercials, I see films from Paris and Hollywood that use those techniques. They've been absorbed into the grammar and vocabulary of world cinema. So that's one of the reasons why I have an entire chapter on culture in the book, because really Brazil's culture is, to me, its crowning achievement. Well, I want to talk a bit of where Brazil came from and how it got to where it is. And that does involve a focus, really, on the economy. The week that I signed the contract to do this book, I was at a dinner party in New York, and the host was a colleague of mine at the New York Times, and he offered a toast to the success of this project. And the person sitting next to me was a high school librarian, and she turned to me and she said, "Why would you write a book on Brazil?" I said, "Well, it's a really interesting country, but it's also an important country." And she said, "Important how?" I said, "Well, where do you think it ranks in terms of the world's economies?" And she thought about that for a second. She said, "35th. I said, "No, 8th. Of course, that was 2 years ago. I see that the Economist Intelligence Unit is predicting that next year Brazil is going to surpass Italy and rise to number 7 in the world. So then I continued in this conversation with her, and I asked, "And what do you think Brazil's number one export item is going to be this year. 2008, this was. And she pondered that for a little bit and said, oh, I don't know, leather hides or bananas? And I said, no, actually the number one export item this year is going to be airplanes, followed by automobiles and car parts. And so that really surprised her. And that's the task that I set for myself in this book, is to explain how Brazil got to that point. And in order to do that, I had to set a base. Now, this book is not a scholarly book. It's not an academic book. And there's some folks that don't like that, but that's a choice I made. And my starting point is really when I first went to Brazil, 1972. So let me just talk briefly about what the country was like then, both politically and economically. In terms of politics, it was a military dictatorship. A lot of leading political figures had been stripped of their rights or forced into exile. The press was censored. I worked for a television network on that first trip, a Brazilian television network. And at the story meeting mid-afternoon, there was a major or colonel sitting there saying, this story you can't do, that story you can't do, this one you can do, but you can't talk about this aspect of it. That's what it was like politically. Economically, Brazil was really linked to a handful of agricultural crops. There's a Frank Sinatra song that probably a lot of people have heard of, right? There's an awful lot of coffee in Brazil is the name of the song. And that reflected the reality that was in place then. Brazil was the number one grower and exporter of coffee. It still is today. But there's a much broader array of products that Brazil exports. Somebody said soybeans out there when I asked about the number one export product. In fact, in recent years, it has become the number one export product, surpassing even cars and aircraft, and I'll explain why in a little bit. But in those days, Brazil was really focused on essentially that crop and vulnerable, therefore, to frosts or the manipulations of the London Coffee Exchange. Well, let's jump ahead to where Brazil is today. And as I said, I want to explain how it got to being number eight in the world, rising to number seven next year. For me, the starting point really is 1994, when Fernando Henrique Cardoso, who was running for president that year, and was at that point the finance minister in the government, got together a group of economists and said, we have got to grapple with inflation. We got to kill this thing and kill it now. Because inflation had historically been the Achilles heel of Brazil's economy. In the early 70s, Brazil was growing 11.5%, 12% a year. Fabulous numbers, but inflation was really racing out of control. When I went to Brazil on vacation in 1991, I was there for a month, and inflation that month was 75 or 80%. In the 20th century, Brazil is the world champion for inflation. We all know about Weimar Germany and the you know, these spurts of inflation, but Brazil was a constant problem. And what it meant was that people, if you get your salary at the first of the month, you immediately go out and spend it because you know that it's going to lose value immediately. And so if you're poor, you stock up on rice and beans. If you're rich, or middle class, I should say, you may buy some sort of appliance, a TV set, an air conditioner, because you can't save. Well, Fernando Henrique Cardoso and his team recognized that until inflation was conquered, nothing was going to happen in terms of sustained growth and development. So they came up with a plan to kill off inflation. It involved, in part, creating a new currency, but it also involved introducing fiscally responsible policies to encourage savings, to redenominate the country's debt, which had been calculated in dollars and shifted into the new local currency. And they were successful. And I talk about it a bit in the book. I don't want to bore you with the details too much. If there's somebody who's an economist out there and wants to ask me afterwards, feel free. But they were successful. What it did was to transform millions of Brazilians who in the past really weren't able to become consumers. It made them consumers. They could buy TV sets or cars or get mortgages. They could buy things on time. And that was a tremendous shot in the arm to Brazilian domestic production. Brazil is today a country of 200 million people. They're taking a census right now. I'm guessing that that's the number they're going to come up with. But if it's not that, it'll be real close. And really, everybody now is a consumer. That wasn't the case in the past. People were excluded from the economy. And that was one piece of intelligent policy. And then there's the luck factor. The emergence of China as the leading developing economy in the world created what is essentially a triangular relationship that has been greatly to Brazil's benefit. Brazilians like to say that God is a Brazilian because the country is so blessed with natural resources. And that has been instrumental in the relationship that's developed with China. Brazilian iron ore, Brazilian bauxite, which is transformed into aluminum, Brazilian copper, Brazilian timber, all of that goes in huge quantities to China, where it's transformed into consumer goods that then we in the United States purchase. So this relationship has been great for Brazil. It's been great for China. We debate, don't we, whether it's been great for us. But one thing it's done is transform China into Brazil's leading trade partner. April 2009 was when China replaced the United States. Now, besides the raw materials I mentioned, here's where soybeans come in. Because in the mid-90s, when the Chinese middle class started to emerge, one of the first things that they decided that they wanted was more protein. And so that took really two forms. Soybeans from Brazil were exported to China for direct consumption, but also to be used as feed for livestock. So it would be consumed indirectly. And Brazil has undergone a tremendous soybean boom. What this says is that our primacy in the United States as the world's leading producer and exporter of foodstuffs has been challenged, and that we are likely to lose that title to Brazil sometime in the next 10 to 15 years. That's a projection that comes from the Agriculture Department. And I'm from the Midwest. As Alice mentioned, I'm from Chicago. I have cousins who are farmers on both sides of the Illinois-Wisconsin state line. And believe me, farmers in the Midwest are certainly aware of Brazil. Colin Powell, when he was Secretary of State, went to Brazil in 2005 and said the obvious. Brazil is an agricultural superpower. Coffee, we talked about. Soybeans, we talked about. But Brazil also has become the largest producer and or exporter of beef, chicken, orange juice. It still holds the title in sugar and cocoa. If you look at an orange juice carton, you'll see that in order to say it's Florida orange juice, it has to be 51% Florida orange juice. Increasingly, the other 49% is oranges from São Paulo. So Brazil has become this agricultural superpower. And the Iowa Farm Bureau put out a study a couple years ago saying, you know, should Brazil's emergence make your stomach churn as a farmer? And the answer was a qualified yes, because what they concluded was that Brazil's competitive advantage is so strong that it's going to be hard to compete. Number one, vast expanses of fertile land that are not being cultivated. The one place in the world where that's the case. Indonesia is another example, but they really have to chop down forests to do that. In Brazil, there's a savanna south of the Amazon that extends for 1,000 miles that has really only in recent years been brought into cultivation. The Amazon watershed, huge amounts of water, a climate that leads, that permits 2 crops a year, and in a few cases, some places, even 3. You can't compete with that. All right, so that's one leg. The other leg industry has developed. I've mentioned the aircraft company, Embraer, now the number 3 producer of aircraft in the world, right after Boeing and Airbus. And they've been very smart. Brazil's been very smart about finding niches, industrial niches. For example, Embraer, the airline company, they can't really compete with Boeing in the large size jets. So what they've looked for is that medium distance commuter kind of flight. So when I fly from New York to Detroit or Columbus, Ohio, I'm usually flying in an Embraer jet. American Airlines and United have ordered hundreds of those planes. Alice mentioned that in 2008 I covered the American election campaign. I traveled with both our current president and his rival John McCain, Hillary Clinton, and Sarah Palin as well. And Sarah Palin traveled around the U.S. in an Embraer jet during the campaign. 108 seats, the biggest one they make. I don't think anybody on the plane besides me knew that it was a Brazilian-made plane. So Brazil's been smart in finding these niches. Cars and car parts are another one that I've mentioned already. 3 million vehicles a year, largely for export. There's a chemical industry. There's textiles and shoes. Much of this is centered around Sao Paulo. That's why Sao Paulo is on the cover of the book. That's where the industrial heart of Brazil is. Then there's a third leg that is another reason why Brazilians say that God is a Brazilian. Again, the hydropower potential of the Amazon is just starting to be developed. There's enormous environmental issues involved, and I'll talk about those, but Brazil has that potential that very few countries have. When the first oil shock hit in 1975, the Brazilian military government, the dictatorship that was in power then, said, we're going to be wiped out. We're going to lose all the progress we've made unless we do something to find alternative sources of energy. And so they looked at the oldest economic activity in the country, which was sugar, growing sugar, and they said, we're going to focus on biofuels, renewable fuels, ethanol. And here we are 35 years later, and Brazil is clearly the world leader in renewable fuels. Every car that when I lived in Brazil, I drove a car that had what's called a flex fuel motor that can run on ethanol or gasoline or any mixture of the two. Every car company in Brazil makes those motors, including the big three here in the United States. So there's a lesson there for us, which is that if we can somehow create an ethanol industry, the technology is there already to be used in the automobiles. So hydropower, ethanol, and the technology that goes with it, which Brazil exports to some other countries around the world. And then in 2007, the kicker. Vast reserves of oil and gas were found off of Rio and São Paulo. It's the largest discovery of oil and gas in this century. In one fell swoop, Brazil's reserves doubled. There's estimates that there's maybe 85 billion barrels out there, which, if true, would make Brazil an oil power on the level of some of those OPEC members. It would probably make Brazil leap past Venezuela as the leading oil exporter in the Western in Latin America, I should say. And it's really changed the equation. In 2007, Brazil really didn't export much oil or gas. If you look now, and I haven't done it in a few months, but early in the year, Brazil was number 8 in terms of where we get our oil from. So it's gone from nowhere to 8 in really a matter of no time. So that's the economic picture. Energy, the energy matrix, extremely favorable. Industry and agriculture. The country is sitting pretty. Let me go back to the politics, because there's been good news on the political front as well. The dictatorship fell in 1985. Brazil today is a thriving democracy. It's noisy, it's fractious, it's tumultuous, but to me that's a sign of health. There are some people who get alarmed by it, but you know, if you're a country that's got 21 political parties, there's going to be a lot of back and forth. And you've got a vibrant press, no longer censored. You have separation of powers with a judiciary that doesn't hesitate to tell the executive, hey, you can't do that, and the executive accepts that. The military, the former power brokers throughout Brazilian history, they're back in the barracks. It's inconceivable that there could be a military coup. It just, I can't imagine a scenario in which that would take place. Now, I mentioned Fernando Henrique Cardoso as the key figure in the mid-90s. He was elected president. He served for 8 years, and he engineered a democratic transition that was really quite remarkable. He was succeeded by a left-wing labor leader, son of a peasant with a fourth-grade education, who began his career as something of a radical firebrand. I'm talking about Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, known to everybody around the world as simply Lula. And he's exactly the kind of figure that the military in the past would have intervened to prevent from becoming president of the country. But that didn't take place. He became president on January 1st, 2003. He leaves office at the end of this year. And though he early on promised a rupture with the world capitalist order, he in fact did nothing of the sort. When he became president, he in essence expanded and deepened and broadened many of the economic and social policies that his predecessor, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, had developed. And so the result is that Brazil has enjoyed a 16-year period of not just economic stability, but political stability that's really unparalleled in the country's history. Now, Sunday before last, there was a presidential election. So Brazil is kind of at a crossroads. This is a watershed election of sorts, in part because for the first time since the fall of the dictatorship in 1985, neither Fernando Henrique Cardoso nor Lula is a candidate. It's a clean slate. You've got candidates, a whole new cast of characters, and whoever takes office on January 1st, 2011 is going to be a new face. Now, Brazilian law requires, in order to win a presidential election, you have to have 50% of the vote plus one. In the balloting on October 3rd, there were three main candidates. None of them got the required 50%, so there's going to be a runoff on October 31st, and two candidates will face each other. The third one was the Green Party candidate. Her name is Marina Silva. She was the former Minister of the Environment. She was an associate of Chico Mendes. Some of you folks may remember his name from the late 1980s, the leader of the effort to save the Amazon. She got almost 20% of the vote, which is a very strong showing for a green candidate in Brazil. But the two people who will be running against each other on the 31st, let me just take a sip of water here. The two people who will be running against each other are Dilma Rousseff and José Serra. Now, Dilma Rousseff is the handpicked candidate of the sitting president, Lula. She is his former chief of staff. She'd previously been Minister of Mines and Energy. And oddly enough, she's never run for public office before. This is her first time out. She hasn't run for city council. She hasn't run for Congress, governor, Senate, anything. Lula picked her because he liked her administrative abilities. He liked the way her mind worked. He liked the discipline. And this is really an attempt to transfer his own popularity to her. So far, it's working. She got 46.9% of the vote in the first round. The other candidate is José Serra, who is from the team that surrounded Fernando Henrique Cardoso when he was president. Serra had been Minister of Planning, Minister of Health. He ran against Lula in 2002, lost. It was thought that his political career was finished. He went to Princeton to teach economics. But he came back, was elected mayor of São Paulo, his home city, governor of the state of São Paulo, and here he is again. Now, he and Dilma really, and I call everybody by their first name because that's what Brazilians do. Politics is really informal that way in Brazil. And so what you have is a situation where you have two candidates, both of whom are essentially technocrats. They don't have charisma like Lula or Cardoso. They're economists who have been behind the scenes writing position papers, and on the campaign trail, they're not exactly exciting. I think you can kind of form a picture of what kind of candidate we're talking about. But those are the choices that Brazilians have. It's really interesting because Brazilians do tend to like charismatic leaders. So the question I ask myself is, well, is this some sort of a sea change in Brazilian politics, or is it just the particular situation that the country faces right now? I don't know what the answer is, but I find it interesting that you have these two rather dry technocrats running against each other. And now I want to pitch things forward, because this is an important election. Brazil has come a long way in a very short time, really a 16-year cycle, as I said, of stability, both economic and political. And there's a lot of challenges ahead. And I don't want to stand here and sound like, I'm hyping things for the Brazilian Trade Bureau. So I want to talk now about some of the challenges, some of the problems that the country is going to face, and which the next president, whoever he or she turns out to be, is going to have to make tough decisions about. And by the way, the fact, I've talked about how Brazil has democratized. The fact that we're talking about the son of a peasant family ending his 8 years of term and transferring possibly, likely, power to a woman. It tells you how the pool of candidates from which the country can draw to choose its leaders has widened immensely, and that's another sign of how democracy really is flourishing in Brazil. But the issue of what, in all likelihood, Dilma is going to have to face, well, these spurts of growth, 7.5% is the number that people are using for this year, has created its own set of problems. The growth has been so spectacular that it's really straining at the limits of Brazil's infrastructure. When I say that, I mean both physical infrastructure and human infrastructure. Roads, ports, all those soybeans, they get trucked or down to the ports of Santos and Paranaguá, where ships sit for days and days and days. That's a problem. That's a bottleneck. Interior roads, lousy railways, deficient river transport, communications that are being strained, even though the privatization of the phone company in the 90s led to a huge boom in communications. And when I say human infrastructure, well, one of the benefits of the Cardoso years was a huge leap in the number of kids who stayed in school and finished high school. Didn't have to go to work, at the age of 12 in the fields. Their parents could finally afford to let them stay in school. But the university system has not really been able to keep up with that. And so you've got a system where, to take one example, the state oil company, Petrobras, which is going to be in the lead on exploiting this oil and gas bonanza, they're estimating they need 250,000 engineers and technicians in the next decade. Where's that going to come from? The country needs architects. It needs accountants. It needs engineers. It needs every kind of professional you can think of. And the education system, as it's structured today, is simply not able to provide what is going to be needed if Brazil is going to continue to rise as it has. So the next president has to deal with that set of issues. Another set of issues has to do with two events that are going to have the world spotlight focusing on Brazil in the years to come: the 2014 World Cup of Soccer and the 2016 Olympics, which went to Rio. Now, Brazil sees both of these events as a kind of a coming out party on the global stage to announce we've arrived, in the same way that the 64 Olympics in Tokyo said to the world that Japan had emerged, and the way Beijing's Olympics in 2008 were a ratification of China's great power status. Brazil wants that. Brazil hopes for that. But there are some problems that have to be addressed if it's not going to be a fiasco for Brazil. I'm talking principally about the issue of crime and violence. That's part of the image that Brazil has outside in the world beyond its own borders as well. This book came out September 1, and the weekend before it was published, there was an incident in Rio where a armed gang based in one of the favelas or squatter slums that's on the hillsides in Rio swooped down from the place where they, their base, and took over a very popular tourist hotel and held the guests hostage. Now, obviously, you can't have that happening in 2014 or 2016, or Brazil's image will be stained, irreparably. How to deal with this? The drug gangs on the periphery of the large cities are heavily armed, often better armed than the police. They have money. They have power. I lived in Rio from 98 to 2008. And every now and then there'd be on the news, there was a mortar attack on City Hall today. It wasn't announced as the lead story because it's part of the fabric of life, unfortunately. Helicopters stopped flying over some of the favelas because they knew that the people down there had RPGs or even surface-to-air missiles. God only knows how they got them. It's presumed that they got them through the FARC, the Colombian guerrillas, who are also in cocaine trafficking and have a relationship with these gangs in the urban areas of Brazil. So this is a huge problem that the next president also has to address. And there's some tentative efforts at community policing taking place, especially in Rio, trying to reclaim some of these favelas and bring them under state control again. But the police are part of the problem, really. I've spent a lot of time in favelas, talked to a lot of people who live in favelas, and they view themselves as being kind of caught in a crossfire between the gangs and the police, who the people living there view as inept, corrupt, and trigger-happy. And there certainly are enough statistics to bolster that set of feelings on the part of the favela dwellers. It's a human rights issue, the number of people who are killed by police, often unarmed police people. It's captured on film sometimes. It causes outbursts of anger, but it goes on. So this is another set of issues that the next president has to address. And finally, the Amazon. The burning you know, every year that I lived there, the issue was, you know, an area the size of the state of New Jersey would be burned down. And Brazil's growth really has contributed to that. And, you know, there's talk about the tipping point whereby if X amount of the Amazon is burned down, then it's no longer a viable, environmental system. We don't know what that tipping point is, but it's best, obviously, not to push our luck. Now, I must say that, I have a whole chapter on the Amazon and Brazil's kind of bristling at the notion that any of us who are not Brazilian have any right to tell them what to do. You know, the slogan is, the Amazon is ours, and the corollary to that is, it's not yours, so keep your nose out of our business. And that makes life tough for environmental groups and other NGOs. But at Copenhagen last year at the World Climate Talks, I was very pleased to see that Brazil's position shifted slightly. It had always said, we're not doing anything. You industrial countries in the north, it's your problem. You created it. You deal with it. But at Copenhagen last December, Brazil undertook for the first time a commitment to reduce its own greenhouse gas emissions by 40%. Most of that, the overwhelming bulk of Brazil's greenhouse gas emissions come from Amazon deforestation. Now, it's not a binding commitment. There's no way to enforce it, but it's a good sign that Brazil recognizes that it has a stake in this problem. And the other thing is that it broke the common front that it had been in with India and China. And that puts pressure on them as well, too, because people say, the Brazilians recognize that they have a responsibility. Why aren't you, India and China, getting in and dealing with this problem as a worldwide problem and not just one that's a problem of the industrial countries? So that's a fluid situation as far as Brazil is concerned. In spite of all these problems, I'm pretty optimistic. Brazil talks about, when I was last there, I noticed a proliferation of slogans and posters, the fifth power. They want to be the fifth power in a world where the U.S., the European Union, China, and India are the other players at the table. It's a pretty ambitious goal. But where Brazil has come from in such a short time says that, you know, yes, it's an ambitious goal, but it seems feasible. And some of the pressure is off Brazil. It used to be said that Brazil is the country of the future. That's a phrase that has been bandied about since 1940. And the Brazilian answer is that, yeah, we're the country of the future and we always will be. But the emergence of China and India has taken that pressure off. I mean, in the past, Brazil always, no matter what it did, it was always falling short of that expectation of being the country of the future. Well, the country of the future, if there is such a thing in our century, it's going to be either China or India. So Brazil can now content itself with being one of the five and enjoying the prestige that comes with that. Now, the next 4 years, the next 8 years, those are going to be the test. And that's what we have to keep our eye on, because it has meaning for us. It has impact for us for all the reasons that I've enumerated. And I certainly will be paying attention. And I think it behooves all the rest of us to do the same. So that's the end of my formal presentation. I'm happy to take questions. So fire away, folks.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Larry Roeder, author of Brazil on the Rise. I am Alice McKeon, and I shall be moderating today's audience question period. Let's begin. Oh, you have a couple here.
Good.
Are there areas that are declining economically either by region or industry?
Well, industry, yes. I mean, I mentioned shoes and textiles. Brazil is getting killed by China. There's no way around that. But what they're trying to do is, to, of course, move into higher value-added activities. Regionally, well, actually, this is a piece of good news, because traditionally in Brazil, the northeast of the country has been the most backward part. And That's changing somewhat. The cities in the interior are booming, and as partly in as a result also of government transfer policies, in which, you know, a specific effort to invest in healthcare and education in the backward parts of the country has benefited them. And so the gap between the rich South and the poor North, which is a historic problem, is closing. It's not to say that the Northeast is at the level of a Sao Paulo or a Rio, but at least there are reasons, if you're from one of those states up in the Northeast, there are reasons now to stay home rather than flock to the South to look for a job. That's as much a part of Brazilian history as people coming from Alabama or Mississippi up to Chicago or Detroit.
Excellent. And we have a wonderful follow-on to that. China worries about the growing divide in wealth that is accompanying the growth. And so is this an issue in Brazil? I think you've kind of answered that in a way.
Well, in a different way. I mean, obviously the Communist Party is not in power in Brazil, so the gap is not a fundamental challenge to everything it claims to be. In fact, Brazil is doing a better job of lessening the gap. I maybe gave short shrift in my presentation to the social policies that began 16 years ago to take healthcare clinics into rural areas, to give poor families a stipend, a monthly stipend, so they would keep their children in school and let them get an education and be contributing members of society. Better housing, rural electrification, all of this is part of what the government has done with the money that it has earned from this commodities boom. It's been invested right back into the society. And there's still huge gaps between the rich and the poor, but they're not as huge as they used to be, and that's an encouraging sign.
Yeah, on the topic of crime and violence, are there other industrialized nations that are assisting with the taking back, or is Brazil kind of saying, like, stay out of our business and we'll do it on our own?
Well, actually, it's not like the Amazon. I think that there's a degree of concern, worry, desperateness. Right. They don't. I mean, I know that some American police authorities, the former commissioner of New York, for example, he's been down there as an informal advisor. The governor of Rio has been up here in the U.S. looking at things and going to Europe as well. So they're looking for what works, and I think on this issue, as opposed to the Amazon, they're happy to get any kind of solution from wherever it may be.
So what's your view on the future of the ethanol program in Brazil, in fact? Now that we have oil discoveries, the electric car in Brazil was unable to come to the United States and other places with this technology.
Well, as a strictly bilateral issue, I think that the number one problem is that we have a 54-cent a gallon tariff on imports of Brazilian ethanol. And as a Midwesterner, I plead guilty because it's my folks who are responsible for that, corn farmers in the Midwest. Corn cannot compete with sugar as a source of ethanol. It just can't. You get 8 units of energy from one unit of energy used in sugar. The ratio with corn is like 1.5 to 1. But we're blocking out Brazilian ethanol imports into the United States, and as a result, people are less willing to invest in ethanol in Brazil, because Brazil can meet its own needs, but it envisions exporting all this stuff, and you need those export markets, and the tariff obviously inhibits the development of an export market to the U.S.
Yeah. Hi. Can you expand a little bit on Brazil's success in directly helping the poor, and specifically, are there elements of those programs that could be exportable to the United States? And as a follow-up, can the Detroit figure out how to get a multi-power use engine in the United States?
Yeah, well, let me answer the second one first, because it's the easier one. You know, Ford, I mean, I've been in the Ford factory and the GM factory and the Chrysler factories on the outskirts of Sao Paulo. They make flex fuel engines there. They know how to do it. You have to untie this Gordian knot that I was just talking about in answer to the prior question. Because what American automobile company is going to want to make those cars with engines like that if there's no supply of ethanol? And so you've got to create a situation in which ethanol is a viable fuel source. Now, on the first part of the question, I suppose there are lessons from Brazil in terms of, lessening social inequalities. But, let's face it, we've been going in the other direction. Social inequalities are widening. And as I saw, covering the 2008 election campaign, going around with both of the major candidates, the phrase income redistribution is a dirty word in the United States. It has become a dirty word. The interesting thing about Brazil is that there's a consensus, even on the right, that this is one of the functions of government, that only government can do this. And so it's not an issue. It's an issue here, and as long as it remains an issue, I think it's unlikely that anything that Brazil has done is going to be adapted in the United States.
Question.
That's a tough question because there's a tax system on paper, but then there's a different one that really exists in reality because a lot of people don't pay their taxes. But that's – all I can say is read the book. I deal with it there. Sure. Yeah. Oh, who's
I have a
mic?
Question in the back here, okay. With regard to population that was not mentioned among the challenges. Does that mean there are effective population controls going on in Brazil?
Well, I think around the world there's a tendency as countries become more prosperous for the number of live births per family to drop, and Brazil has experienced that. When I first went there in the 1970s and I would go up to the northeast, the poorest part of the country, I was always running into families with 12 or 16 kids. I mean, it was absolutely astonishing. And, they would make a calculation, well, if I have 16, 9 will survive and, all that sort of thing. So the population growth rate has dropped into, but we're still talking 200 million people, which is, an amazing number. And it's going to continue to grow till about mid-century when they think it's going to hit a peak of 250 million and then pretty much even out. Does that answer your question? Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I should go by the microphone, right.
I'm English, so I'll probably apologize three times before we finish. I've got several questions, and I want to know if you'd be willing to take anything through email so that we don't monopolize airspace here.
Sure.
And afterwards get the email. But the three that I wanted to comment on just were, I'd urge you, amongst this excellent talk you're giving and this sort of very welcome kind of education of people over here around Brazil, where it stands today, to talk about the institutions. The judiciary is very worrying in Brazil right now.
Right.
It's kind of been kidnapped. The legislative is beyond redemption. By common consent in Brazil, by everybody. But education is a very low priority. And finally, the issue is just the erosion of the middle class. The lower middle class has progressed, but not the middle class. What comments do you have on that?
Well, certainly the judiciary, I acknowledge that that's a problem. I mean, that's in the book. I haven't emphasized it in the talk here today. On Congress, I don't know that I would agree with you. I know that there's widespread disgust with corruption, and part of that is Congress, but part of that is also the presidency and the people around the president. And I find when I travel around Brazil, people, they kind of hate Congress, but they like their local representative, which, says something to me. In the chapter on politics, I make an argument for reform of the political system. It's absolutely necessary because while the economy has jetted into the 21st century, the political system has lagged behind. And reforms are needed. There's too many parties. There's too much money sloshing around unaccounted for. There's too much hereditary dynasties in Brazilian politics. But there are good people, and the country needs more, just like any other country does. So. There's a man here in the first row who's had his hand up. I'd like to acknowledge you. There he is.
Does the government run a deficit, and if so, how much?
Let's think. When was the last time there was a deficit? It's been a while. I can't give you the year. I didn't anticipate that question. But no, I mean, they've been really, really, you're talking about the federal government. Yeah. They've been really, really good for a decade or more. And that's one of the reasons why when the crisis hit in 2008, it was very, very short and very shallow in Brazil. And they came right out of it. Another reason that they've done well is that they didn't allow their banks to get into the kind of madness that took place elsewhere. They had high reserve requirements. They strictly limited banking activities. And that's another reason why they've fared very well in the current crisis. Yes?
Is that Collor de Mello still in the politics? I was there when he was the president, and there was like 70% in inflation, and the real was devalued. Is Collor de Mello still in politics? Was the president?
He was president in the early 90s, and he stepped down rather than be impeached. He was part of the corrupt practices.
He's out of politics now.
Yeah. No, actually, he's back in politics. I mean, he was stripped of his political rights for a decade. But he is now back in the Senate from his home state. And I think that's an example of the kind of cynicism in politics that our English questioner was asking me about.
Our thanks to Larry Roeder for a very enlightening afternoon here. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. You're listening to Brazil on the Rise with Larry Roeder. I think we have time for one more question. Just 30 seconds real quick here.
A lot of the dysfunctionalities you're describing about Brazil can be attributed to the United States today. Is Brazil going to lead us out of the quagmire we're living in? And who is right behind Brazil in South America, and how close are they to catching up with Brazil?
Well, I don't think Brazil has a sense of manifest destiny as the United States does, but I don't think they're thinking of offering us solutions. One thing that their elections are tallied very quickly. Even though they're a huge country, they get the results. I mean, on October 3rd, they had the results by midnight. So that's maybe one little thing that they have an advantage on us, given our recent history. In terms of other countries close to Brazil, nobody, I don't think, in Latin America. Argentina used to think of itself that way, but as a Argentine deputy foreign minister once said to me, it's better for us to be the 27th star, 28th star in the Brazilian flag than the 51st star in the American flag.
Bravo. We want to thank our audience here as well as those listening on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion where you are in the know is adjourned.